Hey, true believers, you know we'd be back, right? It's Steve Raker from the Comic Book Bunker, along with Kevin Whirlwind X and Andrew the L.A. Rabbit. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 293.
We've spent the last 2 weeks clearing beer bottles out of the bunker to make Marvel Noise proper again.
This episode couldn't come out fast enough. to replace what was put up there by our brethren at the DC Noise podcast. If you want to hear more of what you got last episode, listen to those guys over on DC Noise. And if you want to hear us talk about DC books for the first time ever, you can listen to that episode of DC Noise that we did in the swap. You can also find Marvel Noise, which is a proud member of the Deliberate Noise Network, over on Facebook, and you can find us on Twitter, and you can listen to us on our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, where we talk about the indie books that we're grooving on, along with Phil, who we let out for Indie Comic Book Noise. Then we put back in the box.
Except when he can't make it.
That's right.
I open a box, he's not in the box! What are you going to do? All right, I wanted to catch you guys up on what's going on in a galaxy a long time ago, far away. How does it go, Andrew?
Long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Cue the music. All right, so our cast is in a familiar position. It is after the destruction of the Death Star, after A New Hope, and before the events of Empire Strikes Back. Nice little place that the Marvel Star Wars books have made their niche. And we're up to issues 21 through 25, and then I've got 26 through 30 for you also, which will bring us right up to the upcoming crossover with Dr. Aphra. Starts with Star Wars issue 31. But issues 21 through 25 is a five-part Last Flight of the Harbinger, written by Jason Aaron with art by either George or Jorge Molina. And
Harbinger, you say, Steve?
Oh, no. Steve, you have to avoid any words that remind Kevin of Valiant.
We get introduced in this arc to this ruthlessly hardcore, like, crack special ops team of stormtroopers, the Scar Squadron, led by Sergeant Creel. He's the real deal, Andrew.
Crusher, you might call him.
And these commandos get tasked to retake a stolen Imperial Star Destroyer, which was stolen by Han, Luke, Leia, and a skeleton crew of rebels after it was a pretty cool scheme. They forced a evacuation. I mean, the ship was going to blow. And then they stayed on board and set everything back so that the ship didn't blow and stole it. It all comes to a head in issue 25, and although our heroes escape victoriously the humiliated Scar Squadron, they do manage to capture C-3PO. Dun, dun, dun.
He'll hold out, though, Steve. You can't crack C-3PO.
Well, the arc in issues 26 through 30 is called Yoda's Secret War, and it's also written by Jason Aaron with art by Salvador LaRocca. And the Scar Squadron, they can't get over, like, C-3PO's inability to shut up. Like, they're frustrated by the ease of the interrogation because he just won't stop offering up information. Meanwhile, R2-D2 is taking off on a solo mission to go rescue C-3PO. And we don't get to see the fruits of that in this arc up to issue 30. But we do get Luke digging back into the Obi-Wan journals that he occasionally checks out, and then we get like a little backstory. And here you get a backstory of Yoda marooned on this planet that's basically ruled by like pre-adolescence and adolescence. It's like a Lord of the Flies thing going on. And some of them have like a force-like power, and it seems like it's derived from the mountain, and Yoda goes into the mountain, and he wakes the mountain, and the mountain's alive, and then he has to fight the mountain, and the mountain is big, and Yoda is small, so of course there's some cool scenes and story beats of Yoda, you know, exceeding expectations of what a small thing can do against a big thing and all that stuff. And in issue 30, Luke reaches the same planet years later and ends up closing like an open loop that was left in the story. It was cool.
I also really thought it was funny that the Obi-Wan journal is like an old-timey journal.
Yeah.
That I don't even think most people take today. I bet you most people journal on an iPad or something else, but old Ben wrote it just like Samuel Pepys. He wrote it in code and by hand.
Well, honestly, to me, that's the charm of the Star Wars universe over the Star Trek universe, and it's at least what differentiates it to me, whereas Star Trek was, you know, thinking of mankind at its best coming together in the future and everything's pretty good and sterile and institutionalized. In Star Wars, everything's broken down and beat up and dirty and scrap heaps and people kind of living on the edge and you know, farming for water and stuff. So I like that aspect of Star Wars.
So you think Star Wars is like Marvel and Star Trek is like the distinguished competition.
To the clean view of the future that had existed in most science fiction up until that time, yeah, kind of.
I mean, I think that I enjoyed, certainly, that in Star Wars, all the bad guys are British. That's pretty cool. And so I can see why Kevin doesn't like that. But I do like how in Star Trek, I do think that the uniforms are pretty boss.
Yeah. Agreed.
That's the one thing. Like, they should import that into Star Wars. But other than that, I'm a Star Wars kid.
Weren't we all? Except for Kevin.
What? No? Yeah, there we go.
All right. We have been alternating our lead feature each episode from the Thunderbolts revisitations to Power Man and Iron Fist, which we started years ago covering the Power or the Iron Fist stuff. Then we covered all the Luke Cage Power Man issues and marched up right through Power Man and Iron Fist 75. And tonight we're going to finish off the Mary Jo Duffy run and cover issues 76 through 84. But first,
I wanted to share a little moment. Normally, I'm not much for doing events in recognition of things that have happened to me, i.e. my birth, but this year we decided to have a little bit of fun with it. So we started by securing ourselves a spinner rack.
Nice!
So I tweeted a few photos. I sold this from Bob Retall, a.k.a. Comic Spectrum Online. He puts his sketch covers on the spinner rack so you can look at them.
Sure.
So I have a couple racks of sketch covers. I also have one rack of my graded Ditko ASMs, and then just other random issues, like a lot of my old... I have some ungraded Ditko ASMs that I have tucked in there, too. I have a Mr. A. I have maybe an issue of The Incredible Hulk that Kevin might be familiar with tucked in there.
Whoa. You mean the one I just bought over the weekend?
The first appearance of the Thunderbolts Incredible Hulk.
Oh, that Incredible Hulk. Well, the Thunderbolts have a history of the Incredible Hulk.
Thought that would be your favorite issue of the Incredible Hulk. I keep forgetting the Thunderbolts was kind of a phase for you that you quit years ago. And are only hanging on for this one segment we keep doing. But
I like that issue of Incredible Hulk where he gets really mad.
He gets really mad.
Yeah. He just wants to be left alone.
and so we've been doing some, we had a little event, but due to scheduling, it had to happen earlier than my birthday, but it
was
a lot
of
fun.
It's not your birthday yet, right?
No. Okay. And people were super generous and gave me lots of nice gifts, including an ASM 22, which I did not have.
Whoa. Woo-hoo. Cool.
So I've been reading a lot of old comics, but one of the things, the same guy that got me that also got me, I don't know if you can hear it, two unopened packs of Marvel Series 3 trading cards.
Oh, Kevin.
Guys,
and I
never had these cards before. Kevin, this is my first one.
Kevin and I are experts in the card thing.
Yeah, open them live.
So I thought that's what I might do, is open one of these things live and on air. I just took a photo of it. So it's Series 3, so it has the Silver Surfer. I don't know if they all have the Silver Surfer.
No, they didn't.
On the cover. But this is the Skybax.
Yeah.
Randomly packed, limited edition, bonus holograms.
Nice. Ooh.
So here we go. Thanks to Sean for from the Valiant. Those of you that are Valiant fans know him from his podcast about Valiant. Oh, it's got stuff on the inside of the packaging. It's got statistics on the inside of the packaging. You guys never told me that.
Yeah, well, that's where the you get the power ratings. Sure.
All right. So let's see what we have here. We have an amazing triple offer from Marvel 3, the collector's item, the tin, and the shirts.
Huh.
Oh, hang on, guys. It expired December 31st, 1992.
Oh.
I don't think I can get any more. All right.
They're out of
shirts. So I have a team-up card.
They're out of your side. Size.
Ghost Rider and Daredevil.
Mm.
I'm sure you guys have all these, right? Yeah. First team up, Daredevil 295, August 1991. It's number 90.
Is that like Art Adams art?
I don't. Oh, no, it's Tex Sierra.
Okay. Yeah, just flip it over and look. I don't want you to look it up. Tell me with your eye. You can tell.
I was
Art
telling
Adams
me with
Tex
my
Sierra.
Eye.
All right. Good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm also putting my head back to 1991 or whatever.
Yep.
Captain America and Nomad.
Ooh.
Ron Lim.
There you
this
go.
One. This is card number 80. First team up, Captain America 282. And then I have Havoc.
Hmm.
The classic? Or
Nomad. No, the 90s, so he's got a jacket on.
Oh, the X-Factor.
Alex Summers, X-Factor. Nice, that's card 70. I have the Rookies, Pantheon. I have never heard of Pantheon. I call myself a fan of comics.
It's the really? Hulk. It's that era of the Hulk where he was, Bruce
smart.
Banner took over. But he was smart, but he was a little devious. He was, like, put together. He was, like, over the stuff of having been beaten as a kid. And what was it, around, like, 377 or something like that?
First appearance, 368.
Yeah, nice. All the Hulk personalities come together into one uber Hulk, and then he's, like, leads the Pantheon for a while, like a globe-trotting, do-good, like, crack team of commandos.
Yeah, it's almost like, not like the Authority, but, like, something different that... That wasn't...
It was good. I like that era.
Yeah.
Peter David and Gary Frank and maybe Jander Sima.
Well, I have the Hulk DVD collection of comics, and we all need to check out some 90s Hulk. Hulk Smash. Yeah, that's... And I have some villains, too.
Yeah,
I have Blackout from Ghost Rider.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember him because I did buy, like, those first few issues of... Ghost Rider, but...
He was the albino
vampire.
It
never really stuck. Yeah. And then Shiva.
Oh,
okay.
By Sylvester.
That's good.
Wolverine number 50.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's
a bunch of
them. I read this.
She was behind
the
last door.
I wonder if I was out.
Yeah.
I must have been out of this one by then. It doesn't look like a she, though.
It's got
the
claw marks ripping through the cover.
It looks like Strife is what it looks like.
Yeah.
But they're like robots.
Strife.
Yeah. But they're like killer robots. They're like, I don't know.
God, here's a team up for you. Why did they make a card of this? Spider-Man and Sleepwalker.
Oh!
And it's Sleepwalker wearing the Spider-Man outfit.
Yeah.
And first team up from 1991, Sleepwalker number 5. Boy, they really went back to the classics for these cards, didn't they? Oh, this one's a classic, though. Vision and Scarlet Witch.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. These are Avengers 75. That's my talking. Another classic, Wolverine and Captain America.
Hmm.
From 1986, the first team-up.
Is that one
drawn
by...
usually fight or something.
Who draws that one?
And Fantastic Four. Oh, let me... sorry. I'm bad. LW.
Lee Weeks.
Hmm. Oh, good point. It doesn't look...
it is, if it's LW.
It's gotta be, but it looks very...
he did a lot of those cards.
Gestural, I'll say. You know, like he just kind of laid it down.
Laid it on a line.
And then Fantastic Four, but it's them in the rocket.
That's Mike.
So they're wearing their outfits. They're not dressed purple like the Fantastic Four. They're wearing space outfits.
It looks like the Challengers. Are they, is it purple? Did they do the whole Challengers cover?
No, they're in green and green and orange.
Ooh.
And they're in, and they're getting bombarded by cosmic rays. Yeah, if I hadn't read Fantastic Four, it looks like four people in a spaceship. But not like, I like the old one when they're not wearing spacesuits.
Well, the shielding was supposed to be enough.
Exactly.
Supposed to be adequate.
Nice, I like this. I got a cosmic being card, the in-betweener.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
All right, I didn't know they had these cosmic cards. These are cool.
Yeah, that
and
was
then
like
another
a,
rookie.
That was like a 9-card subset there, the cosmic.
Yeah.
Comics. Oh, who's the other rookie?
Talon from Guardians of the Galaxy, which I believe you and McDade talked about. I remember reading that.
He was an apprentice to Doctor Strange.
From Guardians of the Galaxy, number 18 from 1991.
Yeah, the Valentino.
They have the little stats on the back. Although, surprisingly enough, the in-betweener, you'd think his numbers would just all be off the chart. But they don't have his... he's like 4, 5s, and 6s.
Hmm.
7. Like, shouldn't he be all, like, off the... like, how is he not stronger than a 5 or smarter than a 4?
He should be in between that.
He should be in between,
between every number. All right. Thank you, Sean. Only the Valiant. Yeah, that was cool. I'm going to save my other one and do another unairing unboxing at some point, too. But, yeah, what a fun little thing. There's nothing like opening these cards. And like I said, I was out of comics probably by 92. And I don't think I got back in for quite a while. So, this is fun. Yeah, not all new stuff. And it was kind of... but I do think it's smart to feature your new stuff. You know what I mean? Like, that's what you got to sell.
Well, especially the fact that they did waves, like, series of them every year. So, like, Kevin and I noted when we... what was it, back in December when we did that trading card? Look back at the different sets. But when you had those different rookies each year or the different team cards, it was really funny to look to see how they changed year to year. To see, like, who the next wave was, who the next buzz was, what the next event was, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you had your Deathlox and your Darkhawks and your Slapstick and Sleepwalker.
Who knows what Kitty Pryde is wearing this year?
Yeah, exactly. Or Wolverine switched over to his other costume.
Yeah, pretty cool. And he also got me the... Tony Isabella 1000 Comics to Read book.
Yeah.
Which I was of mixed. It was a little cheeky of him to put so many of his own books in his. Like, I know you might want to put one or two, but it seems like you really put a lot in there. And I'm like, is that the spirit of the thing that we're going for? But, yeah, but anyways, it's interesting to read those types of lists because it's just fascinating to see what people consider. Although my other big objection to it is I didn't like that so many of them are really old and hard to find books. And it feels like I'm really going to track down some, you know, Sheena number one. A lot of that stuff I don't think has been reprinted, especially 40s and 50s and 60s books. That's not Marvel or DC. So, yeah, so it's been a fun birthday. The birthday events keep happening. So we had a little party. I'll be going to C2E2. To continue the birthday celebrations.
Jeez, I will be birthday going. Month.
I'm planning to go to the Marvel Insider panel.
Oh.
So if you have any secret scoops you need me to say or do or observe, let me know. I want to go get my free swag and hear about comic books that I can't talk about that'll get released in a week. I love how they embargo news that we're going to release right after this panel's over, but please don't say anything about it. Eh, what do I know? I don't run a publishing company. I'm just a guy making a lot of... Oh, wait, sorry.
Here we are to cover issues 76 to 84 of Power Man and Iron Fist. It is the remainder of the Mary Jo Duffy run writing the title. That ran from fall of 1981 to the summer of 1982. And you can find these issues on the Marvel Unlimited digital service or in the Power Man and Iron Fist Epic Collection Trade Paperback Volume 2 entitled Revenge. And we'll get to that story. We'll end with that story, actually. That's our last story, isn't it? Revenge!
But, oh, and the Daredevil crossover is also on Unlimited.
And is also in the trade paperback. That's Daredevil, what, 178, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
I totally ditched Marvel Unlimited for this. I got this Epic collection for $5.
Nice.
You canceled your subscription over this, Kevin? That seemed like a drastic move to do. You could just read the book without canceling your... Marvel Unlimited.
It's a great Epic collection.
But you can tell this has a defect on it, which I didn't see right away, but it's probably why it was $5. But I care. It's like $5. It has some like glue on the cover. Aww. Which I know, so at some point like there must have been some kind of mishap. Like I don't know if it happened in manufacturing or later, but obviously some glue went on the cover. And then some kind of cardboard was, like, pressed onto the glue. So now it looks like, instead of, like, the P is missing off of the Power Man, like, it's just covered with this weird cardboard material. And I'm like, okay. Well, it doesn't bug me, but it's just weird.
It's a $40 book. Notice? It's a $40
you
book.
When you bought it, that the title was mangled. it was just like, missing the first seven pages. I don't know why everyone would say that.
It's like flat and everything. It's just you have this cardboard blocking the title, and then you try to scrape it off, and it doesn't come off easily. I'm like, oh, well.
If you're desperate, I wonder if you could use, like a solvent, like baby oil.
Just use a razor blade and scrape it off if you need to, or deal with it. Put a book cover on it.
I'll put a dust jacket on it. I hear everyone loves those.
That's what I mean. So that's what they're for. Catch the dust, catch the drips, catch the glue. Now, we had covered up to issue 75. And, I mean, everything had come up to that point, it seems. This is almost, this series of books, it's almost like Hickman after he hit his big story mark, but then stayed on the book for a while and did a bunch of done-in-one stories that were more character-driven than plot-driven, necessarily. And these aren't necessarily my favorite bunch of Power Man and Iron Fist books, but they are the ones that have Luke and Danny in a position where you take for granted for the fact that they're best buds now at this point. That they've gotten there. They've been to war together. When Iron Fist first joined up with Luke Cage, he really stepped into Luke's world. And, you know, except for maybe Jaren Hogarth and his business acumen, which kind of came from Danny's side, it was pretty much Cage's continuity and Cage's baggage that drove the plots along and his supporting cast, etc. And it culminated in that final showdown with the Bushmaster that had Iron Fist rescuing Luke, who was like crucified on that machinery that was designed to rob him of his powers aboard that yacht. But then in our last Power Man and Iron Fist installment on episode 290, we had Danny, Iron Fist's continuity and Iron Fist's loose ends catching up with our duo that culminated with a return visit to Kunlun in issue 75, with this time Luke rescuing Danny, who was crucified, him on a mystical crystal. He was going to be sacrificed to Master Khan by Iron Fist's, in air quotes, Uncle UT, who I can't pass up the opportunity to point out that he is the august personage in Jade. And so now, with their pasts kind of behind them and resolved with each other's help and friendship, and at the very least each other's presence, writer Mary Jo Duffy has our heroes kind of rolling from villain of the week to villain of the week in a series of done-in-ones before she departs with issue 84.
Well, not to stir up the pot, but I actually really, maybe it was just my mind space, I really like this batch of issues. I was grooving on the one and done, I think because it's such a novelty in today's day and age.
Issue 76, is a split book. It's kind of a palate cleanser from the heaviness of issue 75. It has a kind of an awkwardly proportioned cover by Larry Hama and Jack Abel. Kind of looks like Teen Cage, but, you know, dressed in the 70s garb.
And this isn't an assistant editor's month?
Yeah, this felt like a fill-in type of book. I wondered, because I figured 75 was probably such a drama, I wondered if they kind of kept this sort of in the backdrop as like, okay, if we need something, yeah, we can...
This is still in the time where they were doing inventory stories and keeping inventory stories around, and it's also a time where the anniversary issue would be double-sized and would take up the creative team's efforts, you know, 2 months worth of effort. So often you had a fill-in issue after an issue 100 or after issue 75. Here we get 14 pages of what I think was an inventory story here by Mike W. Barr and Chris Claremont, with Rudy Nabree's art mostly and Frank Miller on the last two pages, and inks by Ricardo Villamonte. And it's an Iron Fist lead feature, featuring Claremont's pet character, Warhawk.
Yeah, this is a character that didn't need to be coming back in any big hurry, but I mean, why not? It's been a while because we covered this under the Iron Fist segment years ago, so probably need to refresh some of the listeners on what an awesome, fresh character this was.
He's a steel-skinned army commando type that went a little nuts in Vietnam sort of thing. And he also appeared in the X-Men in Claremont's early issues of that, I want to say around 110, 111, 112, somewhere around there, right before the Savage Land stuff. But here, Warhawk is trying to close out the book on the only single man to ever defeat him in combat, Iron Fist.
As opposed to all the married men that have routinely beat him before.
True.
But it doesn't make me... It just, in like, we're a year or two away from Nuke, who has a very similar backstory, but is handled in a much more compelling way, is why I'm always drawing these two sort of together. They're not the same in power set, the idea of, like, the military guy that gets on experimented on and loses his way, so to speak.
Yeah, everyone's
a popular trope. But.
Everyone's trying to make the next Captain America, that's why. Warhawk starts by to try to take out Danny with like a sniper assassination attempt that fails, and he ends up in a fight with Misty that pisses off Danny pretty good. And Danny hunts down Warhawk to the docks, and man to man, or man to boo. That's pretty funny, with Warhawk kept calling him boo. I was laughing. They fight on this abandoned freighter, and there's a bomb set to go off and stuff. And then in the finale, Danny uses, like, he takes advantage of, like, the awesome Frank Miller art to do some sweet kung fu moves to finish off Warhawk. And then he uses the Iron Fist to bust open the hull and flood the vessel, hoping that it's going to defuse the bomb, but it doesn't. Bomb still goes off. And now he's beaten Warhawk twice in single combat. The second feature is 8 pages of kind of goofiness by Mary Jo Duffy with art by Mark Bright and Ricardo Villamonte. DW, who is Cage's buddy, who runs the theater that Cage's office and residence is above, he and Cage get jumped on the street by this, like, stereotypical, but but smiling and silent, vampire.
Oh, it's another one of those classic things that, where a vampire goes to bite the wrong person.
Yeah, he can't bite him, and everything he does, I mean, he can't do anything against Cage. He's just getting beaten up page after page by Cage. Although the hypnotic thing works for a little bit, but Cage, literally, the sound effects is he pops him in the mouth with his fist and busts his fangs. It's like, fangs a lot. And then the issue ends with an even worse joke about, like, whatever is awaiting the vampire on the other side of his escape route, because he goes through the Lincoln Tunnel, which means he's going to come out in Jersey. Wah, wah.
But it is funny that it's a Marvel vampire. Like, he has the power set where he can hypnotize people, he can turn to fog. Like, it's a legit, it's not the fake out like we read oh so many years ago in the one. But yeah, it was definitely fun. But I don't know. It's like a half book. I didn't drag it out. I didn't think it was that bad.
No.
Besides, I walked through. You're going to see a lot of, like, the fun parts of New York in these upcoming ones. So there's, like, they walk by the theater and there's some Holly and Houston movie and just all kinds of seedy, like, Emilio's Italian bakery. And I don't know, it just feels like it's another place in it. Plus, you know all the tone effects they use, Steve, and how much I like those.
So besides Power Man and Iron Fist, Denny O'Neil edited a few books at this time at Marvel, including Rom, who Power Man and Iron Fist had a crossover with in Power Man and Iron Fist 73, we talked about last time. And Denny edited Moon Knight, who we'll see the next time we cover Power Man and Iron Fist, because he appears in issue 87 of this book. And O'Neill also was editing Daredevil during the Frank Miller, Klaus Janson run, hence Miller stepping in for those two fill-in pages there on issue 76. And Power Man and Iron Fist, therefore, appeared over in Denny's book Daredevil, over in Daredevil 178, which was written and drawn by Frank Miller and Klaus Janson. That issue's tale is framed by two sequences of Elektra, like, kicking silent butt and then being solicited by the Kingpin for employment, which is big happenings for Dee Dee. I mean, this is a big turning point for the whole Elektra stuff over in Daredevil.
I like how Matt just jumps out the window.
Yeah. But that's more for Daredevil's world to deal with. Pertaining to Power Man and Iron Fist, we have lawyers Foggy Nelson and Matt Murdock, and therefore Daredevil. They're protecting this young guy who was employed to deliver these checks that are from the Kingpin to this politician's campaign. All right? And because there are Kingpin thugs trying to intercept this kid and the checks and the lawyers, Foggy hires Power Man and Iron Fist to protect Matt from the Kingpin's goons. And, of course, Matt doesn't want Power Man and Iron Fist cramping his style. So we've got all these instances of him, you know, trying to ditch Power Man and Iron Fist so he can change into Daredevil and stuff.
I thought that Miller and team fit their component very seamlessly into the Daredevil. Like you say, there were big doings going on in the book, and it felt like it didn't. Sometimes these things aren't so smooth, but I really felt like it seemed kind of natural, and they handled the story in a way that fit the tone of the Daredevil book. I was just pretty impressed that sometimes these things sort of just hijack and it feels like everything screeches to a stop as we do our two-parter or whatever, but I thought that was really well handled by the team in the Daredevil side. I mean, I think of it more as a Power Man and Iron Fist story due to the fact that it's like the entire issue.
Well, remember, Miller had just come off of a stint of doing, what, almost 12 Power Man and Iron Fist covers. So we know he had some love for the character, or maybe developed some from having that job. And then he does the little fill-in, and then he has them over in his book once he's writing and drawing one. So I thought it was pretty cool. And I love how he handles, you know, the secondary characters. Miller always did a great job with the Kingpin or, I forget who's Daredevil's snitch guy on the streets there.
Turk.
And Foggy here is handled great, and J. Jonah Jameson. Foggy, when he comes into the office and he's smelling the pizza and he's eyeing the pizza, and then they're talking about the pizza and they turn around to get the pizza and he's gone, and it's like, Foggy ate the pizza. You know Foggy.
I can relate to Foggy. It would be hard-pressed if you left a pizza in front of me.
There are some really neat Frank Miller, classic Miller horizontal panels that depict like the fight scenes between Iron Fist and Daredevil. Really, I mean, so nicely done and just so Frank Miller-y. In the end, the kid gets saved, but the checks are lost in a radar confusing ticker tape parade that's going on. And it turns out the kid isn't so bad. He just did it for his sweet sister, who is a dancer, who hurt her leg and then lost her job in the ballet she was going to do. And because of that, she lost her insurance, and that doesn't seem fair. And she got replaced by some Russian girl. And if only somebody knew a lawyer.
The other thing I like is when they shift. It's that shift in tone. Like Daredevil, especially that time, everything had a tone of menace. Then we go to Power Man and Iron Fist, where the mood gets a lot goofier when you see the Russian connection that I'm sure Steve is about to tell us about.
So now we jump back over to Power Man and Iron Fist. In issue 77, we get a jump from 50 cents to 60 cents cover price. Although, I mean, that was pretty drastic, but it was long after DC had already made the switch. And Marvel would stick at 60 cents for, I mean, they'd hold steady there for 3 years or so, all the way up until issue 116, and this is issue 77, and Marvel would jump to 65 cents. And I also remember DC jumping to 70 cents way, way before Marvel, and that really affecting me dropping some DC books at the time. But 50 to 60 cents, that's a dime. That's like your whole discount. You know, if you were a sub at a sub going at a LCS, took it right away.
And for Kevin, that was probably like $70 back in Canada money.
Oh wow! No, you would just say, "Well, this is where I draw the line, and I'm just going to buy less books." And you kept to that comment till this day.
So, well, you drew the line.
You're reading
cents?
Like one book now.
Issue 77 has a Kerry Gamille, Jack Abel cover that I love. I mean, it has the two big guys about to, like, fighting in the foreground, and a bunch of ballet dancers around, and Iron Fist is being danced on. I like that.
What I'm going to say, in this is one of these books that I spent a lot of time. Gamble and Villamonte have all of these just wonderful textures and patterns in the book.
Yep.
That it's really fun. Like, just great. I don't know. There's nothing. It doesn't feel like now you can patch a lot of that stuff in, but I don't know. It just really works for me in this time period, and you can see all the care and effort they put in. I don't know. I like those little fiddly, and I don't feel it distracts from the action or the figure work either.
Not at all. They spot their blacks real nice. Their pages hold together compositionally really nicely. Issue 77 opens with Daredevil, Power Man, and Iron Fist investigating the ballet theater that the kid was complaining about, only to have the Russian girl in question run into their arms in need of help. Little Elena could not escape Boris and Ninochka. How would you pronounce it? Ninochka?
That's good. Asking me for... Let's get Kevin to pronounce it. He's good with stuff.
No, I was wondering, they're not from the Red Room or anything?
Yeah. Ninochka and Boris is a male-female team of, like, Soviet bodyguards that were sent along with the dancer Elena to prevent her defection.
I think you mean a pair of Soviet stereotypes.
they never mentioned vodka, but Boris can handle Power Man and Iron Fist both, while Ninochka matches up pretty good with Daredevil. The finale is this grand 8-page battle, both off and on stage, on the ballet's opening night. Classic.
It's just part of the show.
I also like how this is still in comics, when you can still have, you know, men and women punching each other in the face, and people are perfectly fine if they're superheroes, you know. Daredevil kicks her in the back, and she punches him in the face. Like, none of this. You gotta have the lady character fight the other lady character. Oh no, we're gonna mix it up. The genders, we're all equal enough to punch one another.
Hey, we know now what the Russians were giving their female athletes.
Well, let me tell you, if they looked like this Ninochka, it would have been a whole different story.
Issue 78 has a Cary Gamille cover, and Cary Gamille, Ricardo Villamonte art team.
I remember buying this year.
Oh, cool.
How are the blacks holding up? I always think that I love those black covers, but I just, the few I have, they always have a hard time. How's it look, Kevin?
It looks pretty good, like... If something presents well, you know, you usually go for it more, like the back cover or something. Like if there's something messed up about your copy, you're like less concerned about that. Like you don't see a lot of the, you know, the black covers. Sometimes you see the ticks on the spine a lot more and everything, and then you're like, ah. But I think my copy's pretty good.
Nice, because I have that ASM that I love so much with the that has the jigsaw on the cover, and the spider light has all that black.
Yeah.
But it's so I have a couple of copies, but none of them are what you'd call 9.8.
Well, all those blacks, aren't the blacks on that cover sort of a little black and red mixed though?
Yeah, because it's the spider signal.
I think it's
so
black
overlaid
on the red. Yeah. Issue 78 is a odd issue in a lot of ways, but hang with us because it all comes to fruition at the end of the run here. Power Man and Iron Fist save a roughed up lady from a street gang, but she confesses to them that it wasn't the gang that roughed her up. It was the hooded street slasher who's been plaguing the area of late. And this they learn from their old pal slash nemesis, El Aguila. The eagle who appears. And, oh no, when they bring the lady to the ER, guess who's working there back from wherever she was?
Claire Temple?
Dr. Claire Temple, Luke's old love interest who ditched him.
Nee Foster?
So we get to see the hooded slasher guy who looks like the Elephant Man, who's supposed to be staying inside and laying low with his unhooded buddy, Frank. Keep that in mind. Oh, and guess what? Spoiler, Jean Grey dies in Uncanny X-Men 137. I mean, the Phoenix dies, not Jean Grey. I gotta get that right. The Phoenix dies. And so that leaves Misty Knight without a roommate. Enter Harmony Young, Luke's girlfriend, the high-maintenance fashion model. And Luke is moving her in here. That's the perfect fit and brings Harmony into the inner circle, just where she doesn't belong.
Ooh, I like check out all the movies that are playing in this issue, too. Sweet Young Thing. Hungry Eye.
This is the New York I want to move to, Steve. I don't see a M&M store or
Misty and Colleen dress like street girls, to attract the interest of the slasher. And meanwhile, they're being monitored by Power Man and Iron Fist and the Eagle. And Misty encounters the slasher, and she's, like, fighting him off. But then Frank shows up because he's looking for the slasher dude who's supposed to stay in the slasher, and he's going out to go get him, sees him fighting with Misty, sneaks up behind Misty. Now it's 2-on-1 until the Eagle arrives. The slasher loses a glove, or a mitten, I should say, and displays this, like, furry clawed hand. And he cuts Misty's faux skin right off her bionic arm. And she looks down and she sees her own bionic arm, and she's gets really mad that she's got a bionic arm and all. So she like punches him. She's like, I've got a bionic arm and I'm mad about it. I'm going to show you. And she punches him right in the gut. That causes broken ribs and internal bleeding.
That's not going to be good.
I love the panel where she freaks out, though. That's a great, like, she just looks at him and gives him, like, a full-on Superman punch to the gut and turns him inside out.
Yeah.
And just a lot of rage, like, the Jackal's not going to recover quickly. Oh, oops.
It's not just rage, it's Misty Knight rage. Like, we've seen that before. And we'll see it again. And then Frank must have slipped away from all of the other guys and got into a vehicle, and he comes ramming into the scene with the vehicle that, like, scatters everybody, and the slasher jumps into the vehicle, and they escape.
Well, the only thing that confused me a little bit was I do like how he honks the horn, I guess, to let them get out of the way. Like, he's not a bad, like, he's not going to run them down and over in their back, you know. He's going to warn them before he hits them with the car.
And at the end, Luke runs into Claire again. And then Harmony sees Luke running into Claire again.
Well, he's a popular gentleman. Women can't refuse. Luke Cage, Power Man.
Issue 79 has a Al Milgram cover and is the last issue of Kerry Gamill providing pencils for the book. Still with Ricardo Villamonte inks here, but it's after 2 years Gamill's been on the book. So good on him. He really was the longest running, most stable. He gave us the most stable art team the book has ever had, to this point at least. And after this, he goes over to Marvel Team-Up for some issues, and he did a cool FF fill-in during the Burn run. And then I don't know what he did. Did he go over to DC or something? I left comics in 85 for 5 years, so I kind of lost touch with what happened to some of these guys who didn't stick around. So this issue is a weird one, issue 79. It is Day of the Dreadlocks.
incinerate.
The Dreadlocks are these rolling robots. They are the Daleks. And this is that unofficial Doctor Who issue that I was telling you guys about. Former son.
Well, he's not Doctor Who, he's Professor Who, Stephen. Yeah. And this thinly veiled.
Former son of the Tiger, now actor Bob Diamond, is playing the part of a Doctor Who allegory, Professor J.A. Gamble, who is a time traveler and all that, in a stage play. But it turns out that the Dreadlocks, the robots, aren't props. They're the real Dreadlocks who time traveled and are hiding amongst these stage items. is the perfect place to launch their master plan. And, like, from the shadows on the street, one attacks Bob and Luke and Danny on the street, like, with lasers. And it was a pretty cool scene with Luke ripping off a car door, using it as a shield, and it's getting shredded by the lasers, and he's using it to, like, you know, gain ground and advance his position. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, they're interesting. I like the look of these better than the Daleks, because first of all, these guys have arms, which seem to be a better, more menacing robot weaponry. You know, you don't need arms, but it's nice to have them. I also like their little dome brains, too. But this version of the professor, you know, who's been around for 100 years or whatever, looked a little too Willy Wonka, I think, from my
Well, case. They needed to maintain their copyright infringement distance, and Luke and Danny stumble upon the real Professor Gamble, who isn't the real Doctor Who, though, but close enough, and they thwart the dreadlocks, after a spot of tea, of course. And his bookstore headquarters is a lot like the TARDIS. It's bigger on the inside than out, and time travels and all that stuff. And Gamble and the dreadlocks disappear in the bookstore at the end of it all. It was Mary Jo's love letter to Doctor Who. In the best way she could pull it off at the time without having the rights. Issue number 80... introduces the new regular penciler Dennis Cohen. And keeps inker Ricardo Villamonte here. And Power Man and Iron Fist have a gig working for this corporate executive type named Emil Fontaine. First, they interrupt a corporate espionage robbery attempt. And immediately, right in this opening sequence, within these first three pages, we get to see the impact of Cohen's penciling style, I think. I mean, Iron Fist's postures, his stances, like when he's twisting the perp's arm, that kind of stuff. Like, admittedly, and especially early on in the run, some of his proportions are kind of wonky, you know? But he draws these moves and like, the kung fu holds and stuff really well. Like, when someone's flexing their back, it looks like they're flexing their back against... you know, straining. He shows straining musculature well, and we should see straining musculature in superhero comics for crying out loud. So then the next gig for Fontaine is Cage being sent to his daughter's birthday party to basically be a clown and, like, entertain the kids with his badness. And there, Cage meets the older daughter of Fontaine, who's, like, this noir femme fatale type.
Except she's like 18 or 17 or something. I thought that was a real fun twist to it. And I gotta say, they keep up with the detailed backgrounds. So I wonder if it's Villamonte that fills in a lot of that. I don't know. I might have to go look up some of these. Wish I could see these pages live and see what was added or whatever. Because it's just weird that they went from two super detailed guys back-to-back like that, so it makes me wonder.
After Cage brushes off the older daughter, Power Man and Iron Fist follow a lead on Fontaine's enemies to this dilapidated harbor warehouse. And there they stumble upon the younger Fontaine daughter, who tells him her older sister was kidnapped by the bad guys. And the bad guys turn out to be goons working for international crime lord Montenegro, the mountain man guy. And we get three more pages of awesome Iron Fist melee moves as he infiltrates and takes out Montenegro's goons. It's good stuff. We've talked about it so many times on this podcast about how this is an era when they still choreographed fight scenes and action sequences over the course of pages. So you really got to see each move, and you got to see the character move from point A to point B, not just a pose and an end pose, and everything in between is understood.
I also enjoy this for a sort of weird synchronicity moment. I don't think you guys play these sorts of games, but there was a BioShock franchise, which was very kind of art deco, like this underwater kingdom that a guy built in the 20s with this theme, and one of the main characters is named Fontaine. So it seems to fit very well. I wonder if maybe the video game team was inspired by Luke Cage and Power Man. But just look at the like the abandoned amusement park detail and everything.
Yeah.
Like, there's just such a lot of stuff you can really focus in on.
I mean, they still have the chains on the roller coaster scaffolding, for crying out loud. Montenegro escapes Hulk, carrying the girl hostage, and quickly scales with his mountaineering acumen a roller coaster scaffold. And Danny starts to follow, climbing after him, and then he's like, nope, I'm not doing this. And he decides to just call upon the Iron Fist and takes the whole structure down.
Although, admittedly, I kind of wanted to see, when he takes the girl hostage, he uses a regular gun. minute, you kind of wanted to see him put that Piton gun up to her head.
Yep. Go right through into his other arm. Issues 81 and 82 are a rare two-parter in this era of the book. And we have Dennis Cohen and Joe Rubinstein with this cover that makes me think of it being kind of an homage to an old, like, Bing and Bob movie. You know, it's like On the Road to Halloween.
Yeah. I'm not sure who is supposed to be who, though, in that.
And Cohen and Villamonte provide the art for issue 81, and Dennis Cohen with Carl Potts inks on issue 82. Story opens with Abe Brown, who was one of the other Sons of the Tiger, along with Bob Diamond and Lynn Sun. After the Sons of the Tiger broke up, Abe was aboard a hijacked plane that likely crashed. I mean, he can't remember. He wakes up 2.5 months later in a Mideastern hospital, loss of his memory of the time between, and now he's back home, but now that country that he woke up in, they want to extradite him for crimes that he doesn't remember over that time period when he was unconscious. Or he might as well have been unconscious, I guess. He doesn't remember. So Abe wants Jaren to be his lawyer and wants Power Man and Iron Fist to go with him because Iron Fist has saved the princess at Halwan twice now in the past, although neither time they've gotten much gratitude. And sure enough, right as they step off the plane, they are attacked. And they get separated from Jaren, who gets taken prisoner. There are these two local youths who help Power Man and Iron Fist learn that Jaren's held likely in the royal palace that's in the center of the city. And they help them navigate the palace and stuff until they run into Ninotchka and Boris.
They couldn't have named her Natasha, really.
Yeah, that would have been better. One of them could have been short. The other one could have been really tall.
Oh, believe me, Boris has got the tall part down. And I like how he speaks with all his broken English still.
Power Man and Iron Fist escape through the quarters of the dancing dervish girls and come up with the fine idea of cloaking themselves and impersonating dancing girls.
Of course.
But, you know, they get called out of the pack. You in the back, come out and do a dance for me, you know? And they have to dance for the king. And that doesn't go well because Danny steps on Luke's dress. You're not girls, he says.
You know, you think that Danny would be the one that would...
I thought the same.
Not, that would be a better dancer.
Luke put his foot where it shouldn't have been, I'm thinking. He made Danny step on his foot.
Well, Danny shouldn't have been grinding up against him, maybe.
Although Luke might have the moves, you know. Well, they're on the run now through the palace, from the palace guards and Boris. They turn a corner, and they come to this trap blocking the corridor. It's a pit.
It's
full
a trap.
Of spikes. Right.
And that is a deep-looking pit, too. It goes all the way down.
And there's spikes all over the place. I mean, it's far enough down that Luke figures if he falls, the speed that he would pick up, those spikes might actually pierce his body. So Luke makes a call at the beginning of issue 82, and he throws Iron Fist to his death. Well, basically,
wow, that's quite a reversal.
That's
how the series ends.
He throws him. He goes to throw him across, like in a heroic martyrdom of himself. He allows himself to be taken capture, and he throws Iron Fist, presumably to safety. But he doesn't make it. He doesn't throw him all the way across. Unfortunately, Iron Fist like twists his body and grabs on just with a fingertip and manages to flip up. But like, if it was up to Luke, he just threw his partner to his death, basically.
The living weapon has worked for years to discipline and control his body and mind, Steve.
Luke gets taken prisoner, but when Abe gets brought in and threatened with torture, Cage just busts free. He's not having that. Iron Fist fights Ninotchka over 3 pages and bests her without his best. And Abe is like remembering being the Black Tiger, this like vigilante
Like a Lawrence of Arabia type,
yeah, like
I think.
A figurehead of like this rebellion. And then he remembers a bullet grazing his head, which took him down and wiped his short-term memory of the whole time.
I do love this comic books and soap opera taught me anything that head wounds just lead to amnesia. No permanent damage whatsoever.
It's just a grazing is all it takes. The Tigers' rebel forces all of a sudden arrive on the scene and they're like enacting a coup. Their weapons are blazing. Luke's got to protect Boris as a shield, and it does him more than once. And then he like uses a tree, like a big fly swatter, to swat away the gun goons. Boris appreciates being saved too.
They also saved him in his first appearance too, when the big light structure was going to fall on him.
Oh yeah,
Luke said. So he's always saving his bacon. But lots of great, nice little lines and colors I like, especially in the Iron Fist fight, where it adds to that sense of motion with the sort of blurred colors as they're moving around. I really enjoyed this bit.
With the coup defeated, Power Man and Iron Fist reach the King's Chamber, and they find Jaren not a prisoner, but a comfortable guest. He's hanging, and in the meantime, while the boys have been fighting, he's been drawing up a territorial agreement and a treaty between the two warring factions, and with the Russians agreeing to not, take over their sovereignty or stuff. And so it all gets settled, and Heroes for Hire gets a big paycheck in the process. So good on them. And actually, in a few of these adventures, they come through with getting a big paycheck. So Heroes for Hire is cooking along as a business.
Kevin, did you break out?
So many floors you can break and so many pop machines you can replace, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking, I wonder how Nightwing Restorations has been doing, because Heroes for Hire is booming.
Kevin, did you get out your Atlas to look up Hal Wan and Murkatesh to see where they were on your map?
No, I should have. That would have been interesting.
What do you think of the Carl Potts inks on Cohen? I've always really liked Carl Potts as an artist, and I mean, he wasn't a fast enough artist to have it be lucrative enough for him, and that's why he stuck to the production side and editorial side and writer, creator, and you know, he co-created Alien Legion and all that kind of stuff even. But I liked his inks over Cohen.
I like this issue a lot. I mean, there are a few inconsistencies sometimes if you want to nitpick it, but it didn't bother me in any way. I mean, there's so many really nice panels that a few that they had to get out quickly aren't going to, you know, it's not like I'm going to ruin the whole thing. It's not filled with goat feet. And
Issue 83 has the art team of Dennis Cohen with Carl Potts again on inks, and also Joe Chiodo, who is an amazing painter and a fantastic artist. Not a great spot inker. This is not his best work being brought on here, but it's still, it's Joe Chiodo. How cool is that? Do you know his work at all? His, like, he does, he was kind of like Bruce Timm type sort of animation-y quasi versions of pinup girls before Bruce Timm. And before that, he was a more straight up painter and did covers for like a lot of the indie books. I'm even thinking like Twisted Tales and Alien Worlds and stuff, the anthology books from Pacific Comics, and then Eclipse after that. Probably did some covers for like Epic Illustrated and things like that.
What jumped out to me is that now I know where George Perez ripped off for his classic Crisis on Infinite Earth #7. The crying Superman replaced by
the Madonna.
Angry Luke Cage.
Yeah, this is a sharp cover. I mean, a sharp Dennis Cohen, Joe Rubenstein cover. And it's the cover of the Epic Collection as well.
And you know it's got me because it's got the nice tone work. Zip-a-tone or whatever they were using.
Yeah,
it's back then. I don't know what
it was still the old Zip. Yeah. Chemically, you laid it down and then you chemically treated it with the one solution and you get the lines the one way. If you do the other solution, you get the other line and you get the different tightness of the dots, the different gauge. Crazy stuff. Crazy that they were doing that to artwork.
I don't know. I remember I used a little bit when I did layouts for the humor magazine in college. I don't know, think it was officially Zip-A-Tone, but it was some kind of same kind of pattern. Whatever would have been the cheap version of Zip-A-Tone, I'm sure was what we're the knockoff version. And just it's just such a fun tactile visual thing.
In issue 83, Warhawk is back. He's in Chinatown, and he's got hostages. Now, Iron Fist, he's beaten him single-handedly twice before. And there's that whole thing about he's got hostages, right? So Iron Fist rushes in, and despite giving Warhawk an Iron Fist right to the gut, Iron Fist gets his butt kicked. But good. Gets put in the hospital, unconscious, laying in a pool of blood and everything.
He gets Bob Diamond, as we're calling it now.
Yeah, yeah. Good point.
Jeez, that's like a Spider-Man 200 thing where Spidey's on the ground. You just see that big pool of blood just getting bigger and bigger.
It's like Daredevil Daredevil standing over a Bullseye on the ground.
Yeah, not pretty.
Well, Luke finds out about this whole thing while he's over at Misty's visiting his girl, because his girl is Misty's new roommate, right? And, I mean, Harmony is hilarious. She's like, she disses Misty left and right. She's so narcissistic about her boots, about her boyfriend, about everything. Oh, you guys wouldn't know what it's like to have a boyfriend. Oh, those old boots you wear. Like Misty's boots, mod boots, they're awesome. Misty's got to have the mod boots, the black turtleneck, and the shoulder holster. That's my Misty.
I think it's a great looking outfit. Harmony's just busting her to get, you know, to knock her down a little bit. But we also are going to get something we haven't had in a few issues, and that's Luke shaking down the street.
He's looking for clues to Warhawk's whereabouts, and his search ends oddly when he gets invited to dinner by Dr. Noah Bernstein, who is the doctor in the prison who made him Power Man. And this dinner, it's a setup. Noah's bringing him and Dr. Claire to dinner at the same time to make them both feel awkward. And Dr. Noah does explain, though, and makes it worth Luke's while, that Warhawk is actually like Power Man Beta. He is essentially, it's like, consider him your older brother. He was the first failed attempt, and Dr. Noah's the one who made him the way he is. Which is interesting, because the same process was the one that he used on Power Man, then afterwards was supposed to be even further enhanced when it was used on Bushmaster, right? And the Bushmaster guy...
So how that worked out.
Well, yeah, but he got more... I mean, the results were more like Warhawk, right? With the concrete-y type skin, not the steel skin, you know? So funny how they kind of retconned where Warhawk came from and everything, but it works. He's like the Power Man before Power Man.
Man,
exactly. That never gets old. So a radio alerts Luke to Warhawk's position in a building, and Luke goes charging in, and he takes a charge or two while he's there, and of course he takes him out, naturally.
All off-panel, though, which I thought was kind of a fun choice to do. Yeah. Like, just to make him more badass. Like, you don't even see how he takes him out.
You see it from the people on the streets' view of looking up and seeing the explosions, and then there's nothing, and out of it walks Luke with Warhawk over his shoulder, much like Danny swum out of the drink with Warhawk over his shoulder after the explosion on the boat, when everyone's looking and wondering what happened with the explosion. They correlate that, you know, these two guys and the way they saved each other from each other's crucifixion and stuff, they put them in the same role. I don't think it's by accident. Issue 84 is Mary Jo Duffy's last issue writing, although Cohen would stay on. And this is Dennis Cohen and inker Steve Mitchell, who I know mostly over Luke McDonnell on the Denny O'Neill written Iron Man book as it marched towards issue 200 when Rhodey took over and the whole Stain International bit and all that. This issue is titled Revenge. There it is. I told you we would get to it.
It's also the secret of the slasher.
Yeah, right. Because who's yelling revenge? It's Sabretooth and the Constrictor, prominently displayed on both the splash and the cover. And Sabretooth, you remember him, the Constrictor's partner, right?
Yeah, this is one of their early appearances.
He's
well, talk about picking out some rare characters, Steve. We may have to do a deep dive. I'm not sure many people know Sabretooth.
Sabretooth, the Constrictor's partner, is whining about how Misty got the better of him. And if only he'd known that she was bionic, that had never happened, Frank. See? Wait a minute, Frank? Right? The hooded slasher guy.
Yeah.
And Frank were Sabretooth and the Constrictor? And worse, Sabretooth is going on and on about how he spent months in pain recovering from that gut punch. Like, how's your healing power now? So,
well, remember, everyone's healing power has, over the power of time, has magically reached superhuman efforts.
True. So Sabretooth wants to get Misty, and of course he's going to just attack the black chick in that apartment. But it's Harmony, not Misty. And he sends Harmony to the emergency room.
What it, like, their hair is completely different.
It was dark.
Sabretooth is an idiot.
Sabretooth doesn't have enhanced senses or anything.
It looks like he might have lost a few teeth in some kind of battle, too.
When he dressed up like a vampire and attacked DW and on the street. So Luke happened to be at the emergency room. He was trying to see if he can get back in with Dr. Claire, to be frank. And then Harmony gets brought in all slashed up and near death, and the sight of her kind of renews his affection for Harmony, and he shakes off this whole Claire thing and goes off after Sabretooth. Gonna make him pay. He also kind of pushes his friends aside in the process of going to do that. But Danny is a friend now, you know? He's cool with it. He's like, the girls are like, you're going to let him talk to you that way? He's not much of a friend. And he's like, no, he's a real friend. And yeah, he can talk like that. He's kind of upset. And that's cool. And I'm going to get right in there and take it again if he is going to dish it out that way. But I'm going to stick by him.
And they make Luke look huge. And I like it. Like a real bodybuilder type.
Madder Luke gets, the bigger he gets. He and Misty and Colleen catch up with Luke and join in for the 6-page fight scene that's on the floor of the jazz club, The Last Call, that finishes up Mary Jo Duffy's run. And this time it's Luke versus Sabretooth and Danny versus the Constrictor, instead of the way it was the opposite the last time they all fought, not counting the Slasher Frank stuff.
I don't see how Sabretooth can beat Luke Cage, though, with a steel-hard skin.
Yeah, well, he doesn't. And neither can the Constrictor beat Iron Fist, because he can just step in between the tentacles and then beat him up. It's like when you get close range on Doc Ock.
Those tentacles are just stuck there, right? They only move in one direction. Once they're out, you're like, ah!
On the last page, Duffy wraps up her run by making Montenegro be behind it all. He was behind Sabretooth and the Constrictor. He was behind this. He was behind that. He was behind everything.
Can't trust those guys that are in the mountaineering, Steve. That's the lesson I learned.
So what'd you think of Mary Jo Duffy's run? I mean, again, do you see why I sort of make the Hickman connection, that it's like she built up to that 75 and that was the big story, that was the pitch, you know, and then we sort of have a lot of these done in ones that are really character pieces that really don't build towards anything or go anywhere other than give us month after month of off the rack good Power Man and Iron Fist stories.
I liked a lot of the one and dones and stuff, and I don't remember that being a hallmark as much of the Hickman stuff, but I'll need to get back into that, I guess, and revisit it. I really liked it. I thought the art was pretty strong the whole time. Like, really, just even with, you know, a few people sliding in, going, replacing Gamble and everything, I was in, you know, they're different, but I didn't feel at all it was any kind of step down or step up, like a nice lateral move.
And,
Kevin?
And what does 2017 Kevin think of this?
Well, I think your continuing stuff is in the character and the all the apartment drama and all that stuff. So you're still moving forward, just it's like reversed to what it used to be.
It's a family book now, isn't it? There's a family cast here. And after this, we are going to have editor Denny O'Neill hand off the editing reins to Ralph Macchio. Ralph, I'm not the Karate Kid, Macchio. And you know, what does Denny do when a writer leaves his book, you know, after a long run? He writes the book himself. What does he do when Frank Miller leaves Daredevil? He takes over writing Daredevil. What does he do when Mary Jo Duffy's off the book? He takes over writing the book, at least for a few issues. Then he's going to give the book to a young writer who this is going to be his first real gig. And that's going to be a young Kurt Busiek, who's going to take
the book
up to issue 100.
Well, it is really tying into Thunderbolt.
Yeah.
In a scary way. Make it stop, Steve. I can't take all these coincidences.
But writer Jo Duffy, she gripes some in looking back at this time period and being taken off the book, saying that there was a lot of pressure from editorial and other writers to make the book more dark and gritty and to make them more superhero-y, more punch-first type situations, to make Luke and Misty be the couple because of their attitudes and probably skin color as well. And she said she was taken off the book because of the whimsicalness that she, the tone that she kept in there, that they wanted more supervillains, etc. So I'm curious, when now that we're going to have the editor write the book, are we going to see more supervillains, and are we going to see a tone change? Are we going to see reverence to this formula that has been working now since they brought these two characters together?
I don't know. I like the Sabretooth showed up, but you can have some of the more Iron Fist-like villains, too.
Sabretooth? How can you have more Iron Fist villains than Sabretooth? Like, that's where he debuted.
Because Sabretooth is an X-Men guy.
Well, it's going
Our Wolverine guy.
Yeah, well, a lot of Jo Duffy's run, a lot of this time period of Power Man and Iron Fist was very tied to Claremont's vision because of a lot of the pieces of Iron Fist's world that Claremont put into place, and then the setup of the Power Man and Iron Fist collaboration that he got off the ground. So they used a lot of his characters. Sabretooth was a Claremont character from Iron Fist, and et cetera, Warhawk and all these guys. And even the Kunlun stuff with UT and all that business. So it'll be interesting because Busiek does reintroduce the Iron Fist stuff. And spoiler, 100 is the return to Kunlun.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why that has been my ultimate goal, is to get to 75 and then follow it up with the sequel of 100. And it's so great. I mean, the whole family, we kind of commented on how the supporting cast has become a family. That's what issue 100, as I remember it, is the whole family storming Kunlun. El Aguila, you know, the Bob Diamond and Misty and Colleen, they all go to Kunlun. So I hope you'll join us, you dear listener, for our excursion as we get there. It's going to take us two more installments to do so, but we can do it, And then
all the coon lunatics.
Coon loonies. But next up, we'll have the Thunderbolts on episode 294 and some recent reads. And hopefully we'll get some info on Andrew's visit to C2E2.
Oh, for sure.
All right. Thanks again, guys, for joining me on this journey. Until our podcasts have Sabretooth chiefly remembered as Lenny to the Constrictor's George, make mine Marvel. Later.
Came on slowly, pushing.